it's important to maintain high standards for what we believe in. And one of the things that the new conspiracists do is they try to lower these standards by inviting people to substitute a low standard of true enoughness. Oh, that's true enough for something that, you know, for the higher standard of really being true.
That's Russell Muirhead, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. Russell Muirhead is the Robert Clements Professor of Democracy and Politics at Dartmouth College. His previous books include The Promise of Party in a Polarized Age and Just Work. He joins us to talk about a lot of people are saying, the new conspiracism and the assault on democracy, which he co-authored with Nancy Rosenblum. Russell, welcome to the program.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
Well, tell me a bit about what led you and your co-author to write this book.
You know, Nancy and I were writing about parties and partisanship. That's what we ordinarily write about as political scientists. And we came to see that something new was happening. In part, the tradition of the legitimate opposition, where each side looks across the aisle at their opponents and see someone they want to defeat, but not somebody they think should be imprisoned or punished for disagreeing. That tradition started to fray in recent years, as increasingly people, especially on the far right, began to describe Democrats as a kind of conspiracy bent on destroying the country. Now, this isn't exclusive to the far right, but we noticed this language cropping up, and we thought, wow, this is sort of a reversion to a much older practice back to the 18th century, before the idea of a legitimate opposition really took hold. And that's when we started thinking about conspiracy and the new kinds of conspiratorial allegations that are arising in politics.
Well, the subtitle of the book is The New Conspiracism and the Assault on Democracy. So tell us a bit more about what you mean by conspiracism and how that's different from what we would normally think about sort of classic conspiracy theory.
Yeah, the words conspiracy and theory just seem to go automatically together. As soon as you hear a conspiratorial allegation, you think, well, there's a conspiracy theory, or if somebody who's making it, say that you call a conspiracy theorist. But what Nancy and I noticed is that there's really something new happening. What we're now getting is conspiracy without the theory. The classic example might be something like Pizzagate. It's not clear what Pizzagate is trying to explain. It's not clear what data or what observations or what observable things in the world it's trying to make sense of. It's kind of a concoction. It says that, you know, Hillary Clinton and her campaign manager, John Podesta, her campaign chairman, were running a child sex trafficking ring out of a pizzeria in Chevy Chase, Maryland. And this isn't like the classic conspiracy theory that's starting with something that's kind of hard to understand. You know, how did 19 people without a lot of resources successfully destroy the World Trade Centers and attack the Pentagon? 9/11 conspiracism says, well, there is actually a bigger cause at work. The United States government was in on it, in on the planning. That makes sense of something that's hard to understand. It might be false, it might be true, it might be some mix of the two, but it's a theory that's trying to make sense of the world. The new stuff is, it's like a fabulation. It's a wild story. And if it's making sense of anything, the only thing in this case, like Pizzagate, that it's making sense of is why somebody might oppose Hillary Clinton, not just because she has policies that, on balance, are less worthwhile, less persuasive, but because she's torturing children.
In this case, I remember, if I'm remembering the details such as they were, that this was being operated out of the basement of the pizza establishment, when in fact there was no basement.
That's a great point. I mean, that's exactly the kind of thing that we call attention to. It's making up a new reality. It's distorting reality. You know, again, classic conspiracy theory is trying to make sense of the world, a world that's often very, very hard to make sense of. And it's trying to call power to account in a world where power often, you know, the powerful institutions and powerful people often do many rotten things and cover them up. So conspiracy theory is reacting to the world as it is. This stuff is just, it's inventing basements where basements don't exist. It's inventing stories out of people's imaginations.
You write in the book that this conspiracism delegitimizes democracy. Explain that a bit more for us and how that has that effect.
It does two things. One is it calls into question a whole array of what we call knowledge-producing institutions. And we have our eyes in particular on these sort of lonely agencies that are staffed with experts, like the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which compiles things like the unemployment rate. It's basically staffed with social scientists who are trying to get at data, or the National Weather Service. These aren't particularly controversial places. They're not making policy. They're just trying to gather facts so that policymakers can make effective decisions. And, we might say, Nancy and I believe, that you need good facts to make decisions, whether the decisions are conservative ones, are liberal ones, or are just plain centrist decisions. You still need good facts. The new conspiracism puts those facts in danger. It erodes our access to the terrain of factuality by calling into question the integrity of all of these sort of lonely agencies filled with experts. It says that, you know, the National Weather Service is actually conspiring to fake data about global warming, or the Bureau of Labor Statistics is conspiring, the civil servants there, or conspiring to kind of muck with the unemployment rate to make Obama look good. This is something that Donald Trump alleged about the Bureau of Labor Statistics when he was a candidate. He said that the actual unemployment rate was much, much higher than the Bureau of Labor Statistics said it was. The actual rate was like 40% and not, 6%. And we worry. We worry about a political world where there's no knowledge-producing institution that can provide decision makers with facts, where we lose our trust in all of these things. That will make democracy function much less successfully, and it'll make democracy eventually look like a less effective, unworthy way of conducting politics. It will make it look like a regime that's not very legitimate. So that's one worry we have. The other worry we have is, like I mentioned up front, this idea that the opposition is itself a conspiracy bent on destroying the country. And the more we tend to think of our political opponents as not just opponents in the electoral game, but as conspirators who are opposed to the regime itself, the less likely we're going to tolerate them peacefully. The more likely it is that we'll try to jail them or do violence to them. And when that happens, the peaceful game of democratic elections is going to turn into something much, much more dangerous. And here we worry about the one-off kind of conspiracy without the theory that goes by like the term rigged. The election was rigged. The Democrats are conspiring to defraud the voters, defraud the citizenry by running rigged elections, by busing voters or something into New Hampshire. And again, there's no observation. Nobody saw the buses. Nobody knows what's, there's nothing that's trying to be explained here. It doesn't even really make sense that the president is responsible for this conspiratorial allegation, because actually he won the election and everybody agrees he won the election. So it's very odd to see the winners of an election say that the election was rigged. But that's what we have right now. And, if you play this out a few more rounds and see it going forward, I don't know, for another 5 or 10 years, you begin to see how it might actually cause the practices of democracy itself to look like they're not legitimate.
To me, that begs the question, what can we do about it? In some ways, this conspiracism seems to be a symptom of a larger problem, but how do we counteract it?
Yeah, if the larger problem that you're alluding to there is the problem of sort of, misinformation, systematic deception, we're with you. That's right. It is one aspect of that. I'll tell you, we worry a lot about the staying power of conspiratorial allegations. They seem to stick around a lot longer than a sort of one-off piece of misinformation that might have an effect for, one news cycle or only matter with respect to one issue. So although it's a feature of a larger problem, we see it as a particularly potent one. And I'll tell you, one thing we want to do, one just very, very basic thing that we want to do is name the unnamed, is give a name to this force, the kind of conspiracism that we see in politics today, and let people know that it's conspiracy without the theory. We think conspiracy theories have a certain kind of, authority. Like they're things we should pay attention to and think about. And like I said, they might be false. which case we shouldn't believe them. Might be true. There might be a mix of the two. But there's a kind of authority that comes with the term conspiracy theory. And we don't want to confer that authority on the new conspiracism. So that's the first thing, is we really want to diminish its force by calling it what it is, which is, you know, concoction, fabulation, make-believe, allegation. You know, secondly, Nancy and I believe in the power of common sense, and we want to call on people to invigorate their common sense and stand by it. If you're hearing something that isn't making sense of anything that you could see or hear or notice, if you're hearing something that sounds like fabulation, stand by your common sense. We think that it's very important at this point in time, not so much to persuade people who are given to believe in these sorts of things, but to strengthen the resistance of fair-minded onlookers.
So I guess that answers in part the next question I was going to have for you. It's just basically, how do we protect democracy in the face of these threats? And I guess the first thing is to stop and think. Does this make sense?
Yeah, that's right. Stop and think. And here's another very concrete idea. It's important to maintain high standards for what we believe in. And one of the things that the new conspiracists do is they try to lower these standards by inviting people to substitute a low standard of true enoughness. Oh, that's true enough. For something that, you know, for the higher standard of really being true. Let me give you an example. A couple of years ago, a congressman was voicing the conspiracy that leftists arranged for a confrontation of white nationalists and protesters in Charlottesville in 2017. And this member of Congress said, "I'm not saying this is true," he said. "I'm just saying it's plausible." Well, that's a way of lowering the standard. He's saying, look, I'm not asking you to actually believe it. I'm just asking you to kind of sort of maybe believe it by saying, well, in some kind of world that you might plausibly imagine, it's plausible. And that's a way of lowering the standard. And when you hear that, we want to call on our fellow citizens, you know, say, when you hear that kind of thing going on, say, no. If you're not saying it's true, then don't say it. Maintain a high standard. And public officials should maintain a high standard about, you know, with respect to the notions, the ideas, the theories, the propositions that they give voice to.
You address this in your book. You have a chapter about who owns reality. And if people don't question what they're being told, then their view of what is real and what is not becomes confusing. Tell us a bit more about that.
It can be, you know, very disorienting to, you know, inhabit a political world where these sorts of allegations have so much traction. I mean, another example is a few years ago, there was a conspiracy, the famous sort of the notorious Alex Jones was responsible for propagating this down in Texas. And it was an allegation that the United States Army was conspiring to invade the state of Texas and declare martial law and confiscate people's firearms. And, you know, there wasn't a shred of evidence to go on, you know, for this allegation. And the governor at the time, Governor Abbott, instead of standing up to it and saying, look, this is just not true, reminding citizens to be skeptical, to be vigilant, of course, but also to maintain hold of their common sense. Instead of that, he called on the state National Guard to accentuate their protections of the Second Amendment liberties of Texans and to be on particular watch for the United States Army's invasion. And so he ended up, you might say, giving in to the conspiracists instead of standing up to them. And that can be very disorienting. It can cause people to wonder, you know, what's real and what's really going on.
Russell, obviously there's a lot that we didn't have time to talk about in this book, but what would you say is the takeaway for readers? What would you like them to do with this information?
You know, I really want people to deauthorize, to demote the kinds of unsubstantiated fabulations that all too often are getting a lot of traction and are being repeated a lot, even by officials in our politics. And just to remember the difference between conspiracy theory that's trying to, you know, give an explanation for something that people can see. Again, might be right, might be wrong. But to get the difference between that and pure fabulation, pure concoction, conspiracy without the theory, and really resist with everything we have this sort of new form of conspiracism.
Russell, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. You're welcome, and thanks so much for inviting me to join you.
The book by Russell Muirhead and Nancy Rosenblum is A Lot of People Are Saying, The New Conspiracism and the Assault on Democracy. You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansaspublicradio.org/conversations. You can use the KPR app to listen on your phone or tablet. You can sign up for the Conversations podcast on iTunes, and you'll find us on Facebook. Conversations is a production of Kansas Public Radio. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.